It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today's show is coming from Girdwood. At the moment, actually, I'm way up on the side of Mount Alyeska in the Roundhouse Museum, which is at the top of the tram that runs up from the hotel, and it's really well worth checking into. And I've got a great treat today. We're going to talk about the resort, the skiing. We're going to answer all the questions you have as you're riding up the lift, wondering about, like, what is that guy doing, and how does this place work? In the first half, I'm really excited to have a guest who has been here pretty much the whole way along and knows all the history of Alyeska and has had a huge hand in building what we all think of as our hometown ski area, Chris von Imhoff. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Charles. I'm glad you came up here. It's snowing and blowing, but the snow conditions up here on top of the mountain are great. Visibility is a little bit more limited, but at least there's plenty of snow up here so that that the people can enjoy themselves. And spring break is just coming around the corner.
Yeah. Well, I think that right now we are in complete whiteout, so the beautiful views are just white. Fortunately, I've seen them many times before. But once this snow stops falling, it's going to be great. And that's one of the things I want to talk about today is, like, just because it doesn't look like there's good skiing in Anchorage or down at sea level, up the top, you know, the skiing goes on and on and on. And that's one of the main reasons this is such a great place.
Yeah, actually, we were fortunate that in the upper half of the mountain, we have tremendous snow conditions, not only here, but also then for the heli skiing. We have now quite a few guests at the Hotel Alyeska coming from all over the States and Europe, and the heli skiing has been superb, so the combination is really great.
Yeah. So tell me the first time you ever saw this mountain or the first time you ever skied this mountain. I'm just curious as to what it was like then compared to what it's like now.
Well, if I tell you, you think I'm going to be pretty old, but anyhow, I first moved up to Alaska in 1963, and I worked for Scandinavian Airlines System, SCS, and transferred to Anchorage, was in charge of the Alaska polar region. And during that time, I came out at that time to Alyeska a few times to go skiing, and at that time, I only had one chairlift, chairlift number one, and this roundhouse, and a day lodge and a few rope toes. And so that's when I first skied a few times and I really fell in love with it. I thought it's so such a beautiful scenic area. So then a few years later, when I was director of tourism, I promoted Alyeska more, not only from for within Alaska, but from stateside. And then I talked Alaska Airlines into take it over in 1967. And that's when I first joined on behalf of Alaska Airlines. I was the new general manager. And
that's when you started running the resort?
Yes, correct.
So are you from Austria originally?
I'm from Bavaria.
Okay.
Where the hills are alive. Yeah, from Garmisch-Partenkirchen, which is an Olympic ski resort in southern Germany.
So did you learn to ski there?
Oh, yeah. I grew up and, you know, like most people live in the ski areas. You learn how to ski at an early age. And then in school, it's mandatory. You go once a week at least to different ski areas. So, yes, I had a chance to learn it fairly early.
So skiing in the Alps is famous and has always been, like, goes way back. But skiing in the United States is more recent. And skiing in Alaska started right here. You know, you were just sort of at the dawn of it.
Well, it's right. In Europe, and the Alps, of course, it was much longer, rated traditional. In America, it became very popular after the war, World War II, when the 10th Mountain Division, there was a lot of people learned how to ski. And later, some of those same persons, they founded ski resorts, including like Vail was founded by a gentleman in Washington. And so, yes, this resort here got its start in 1960. And the original investor was a Frenchman, François de Gansberg, that was convinced by local residents and local to help financing. And so he was a wealthy man and he had good connections. So he's the one originally. I got to give him credit. In the early years, he financed his chairlift number one. At that time, was a French-made lift called Paul Magalski. And he ran it, he and his manager Jim Branch ran it the first years when it was started.
Is this the best spot around? I mean, did they choose the best spot for a ski resort in our region? I sometimes feel like it rains more here than I really want it to. On the other hand, we get plenty of snow up here.
Well, you know, there many times of all the years I wished that we would be 1,000 feet higher.
Yeah.
At midway or like the height of Turnagain, because it definitely has been, all the years, to me, that was the most challenging part. Sometimes you had great snow condition at the base, and then a warm monsoon season comes in and then wipes out some of the snow in the lower part of the mountain. So from that standpoint, it was... A little bit low, just like in British Columbia, Whistler actually faces a similar situation. The lower half of the mountain is often also not quite as much snow. But on the other hand, the upper half is, and the terrain, including the north face and the whole glacial bowl, and as many years we had great conditions all season long.
Mm-hmm.
I got to give credit, you know, originally our company, when it was under Cebu Prince Hotels, and then later with the new owner, the John Byrne and his team, they expanded the snowmaking system. And with that snowmaking system, now you have a much, much better base from top to bottom, and especially lower half of the mountain, because when you make snow, when the temperature allows it, it has to be below zero. I mean, below freezing,
yeah.
But that really helps to build the base, and that's why right now even the boulder and the racing trail still have a good base, even though with the warm weather.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's been really nice skiing this year. I've really enjoyed it. So tell me about what it was like skiing here in the 1960s. I imagine people were just starting to learn how to ski in Alaska. I mean, what was the scene like down here?
Well, it definitely is, and especially the early years, it's a very advanced mountain. Lots of steep terrain and so on. And those early years, we didn't have any snow cats either. And so sometimes come springtime, there was moguls that were taller than mountains.
Oh, my gosh,
it's a tough mountain. But since then, a lot of grooming has been done and a lot of trail blazing and in various places, especially in the lower half of the mountain, so that if you want to go down, just like here through the bowl, the cat trail was put in there, or on the lower half, the Vanimov trail, and so on,
yeah.
Just in order to be able to allow even intermediate skiers to come. Beginners should stay and learn first with our ski school down at the base area,
yeah.
And there is this fantastic bear quad chair, mm-hmm. which is ideal, and then a couple of magic carpets, and this was all just added in the last 10 years, and mm-hmm. Especially there's magic carpets, and that's where you can learn. And then once you get to learn on that, then if the weather's good and the hills are groomed, then you can manage to get down all the way. But it's good at the beginning to have a good coach, a good ski instructor, yeah. to go with you.
But back in those early days, you didn't have the equipment that we have now, which makes it so easy and safe. I mean, it's sort of like we're just strapping boards on your feet and just learning. But it sounds like, I mean, when I look at the pictures of it, it looks really fun, and it looks really kind of a little bit more of a frontier feeling than we have now.
It definitely was a frontier type of a ski area, as I say. Uh-huh. And on top of it, neither the original investor, and then even under the management of Alaska Airlines, which at that time didn't have much money either. In the early years, they were struggling. We mm-hmm. called them Elastic Airlines. And,
true.
And you had to wind up the elastic to take off, right?
They actually were prohibited when I took over. I thought they were going to be able to put a lot of money into it, but they were prohibited by the Civil Aeronautics Board to put any money into the resort. So, so we didn't have a lot of money. But it definitely was sometimes challenging to develop the resort, but we finally built the upper another chairlift, and then another chairlift, and then we built four chairlifts in the 70s, then we put night lighting in and started mm-hmm. with the snowmaking, and so slowly but surely over the years we expanded and improved, and so it's now 10 times better than what it used to be when we started out.
I was looking at some pictures. It looked like in 1973 there was some kind of a big avalanche that took out one of the lifts.
Oh, yeah. We had several times challenges. But first, I want to emphasize, of all the years, as much as we are real high class, I mean, high area, avalanche hazard area,
yeah.
But with the proper avalanche control, we have prevented any fatality for mm-hmm. the skiers, because we are very conservative in terms of opening the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, in the early 70s, actually in 1972, we finally built chairlift number two. And I was so proud that finally we opened up the upper half of the mountain, which is where now the spirit of Alieska is.
Yeah.
And called it Share 2. And so, and it was the first profitable season, and everyone was happy.
Well, after 12 years, you made money for the first time?
Yeah. I guess you were happy.
Before I was hawking real estate, and I tried to get loans in here. Actually, one time I tried to get a loan from a local bank, a prominent bank, and the banker, which is, we're now related with him, he almost laughed me out of the bank. And but anyhow, we built this chairlift, and in spring of 1973, in April, we had a snowstorm just raging, just 1 week long. It snowed and snowed and snowed. It was a terror. We closed the whole mountain because it was snowing and blowing real bad. And but we were shooting. We had two 75 millimeter guns, and we were shooting and hoping to release some of the
knocking those avalanches down with the artillery.
However, those guns weren't quite as effective as the one we got since then. Anyhow, so come April, one day my mountain manager calls me early in the morning and says, "Hey, boss, got to come to the Day Lodge parking lot. I need to show you something." It didn't sound good. And so I went there and to look up in the canyon. By that time, it finally cleared after 5-6 days. And sure enough, there were some red towers, which I knew were the tower and the terminal from lift number 2 from the upper half of the mountain. The whole center ridge, the whole mountain had released from one end to the other, and just all, and were the Forest Service, and we had studies, and they said, oh, only 100 years, maybe something like that would happen. Well, it happened, and it wiped out that lower part of the lift 2-3 towers and the drive terminal at the base of the mountain, at the base of the ski hill. Oh, I tell you, I was shocked and devastated. Anyhow, so yeah, it was in the canyon, and so all the ski patrol and lift crew, everyone went out there to check out the damage. I went to my office and reading the insurance policy, and then I pretty well knew what it was. But then I called the insurance broker in Seattle and says, you know, that Graham, I think I'm just reading my insurance policy. And he said, "What the hell are you reading on Saturday afternoon insurance policy?"
It's a bad sign, yeah.
I said, well, and I told him that we lost the lift terminal and needed to rebuild. It was a $10,000 deductible, so we rebuilt it the following summer. But the other thing I did shortly after this situation happened, because Senator Ted Stevens was a good friend, and I used to know him even when I was director of tourism. He was in the state legislature, and I called up and said, "Senator, I need your help, because I'd been trying to get through the military the 105 millimeter guns instead of the 75s, and because other skiers had it. And the military said, oh, maybe they didn't trust the Germans." And anyhow, so they, but then I asked the Senator if he could intervene on our behalf. And since we had the 105, it's 5 times the detonation power. So when you shoot there, you know you're getting the impact. And so we feel we have a much safer mountain.
Wow. I mean, so many challenges over the years with, you know, the keeping the things going, improving it. It just, all, you know, it seems like a real lifetime of, a lifetime journey, right, to build it. You must feel a great deal of accomplishment when you look around this place.
I had lots of setbacks. Even the little article here is from one of the folks that wrote about it, that every time I had a setback, I managed to somehow get back on our feet and hawk a little more real estate. You know, Alyeska also had the subdivision, which we leased properties. First was a sublease from the state lease land, and later we sold them. So I hawked that, but then helped promote the resort, not only locally, but nationally and internationally. We hosted the international airline ski races, and we hosted U.S. and national and international races. In 73, before that lift got wiped out, we hosted the World Cup races.
Is that right?
And so the racing program, to me, is one of the most important things that helped the resort to develop a good customer base. The Mighty Mites, the Alyeska Ski Club, and all the different racing programs, most of the people bought cabins, condominiums, and they bought season passes. Mm-hmm. They ate in our restaurants and bought lift tickets. And so that really helped to kind of put us on the map, not only locally, but nationally. And we then, as you may know, we were here at that time when, and then in 1984, there was the Olympics going on in Sarajevo. And I followed them because I grew up in a Winter Olympic resort in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany. And my uncle actually was an IOC member, International Olympic Committee. And And so I compared Anchorage with some of the other cities, like Squaw Valley that hosted it, and in Europe, different. And I said, I think we could do it. So I got together with Rick Maestrom, which at that time was our advertising agency representative, Maestrom Advertising. And I had lunch with him, and I told him I think Anchorage could host, put a bid in for the Winter Olympics. And initially, oh, this is, you're dreaming, and so on. And I gave him all the facts and figures. And then I had a meeting with the ACVB board of directors, and I made a presentation why Anchorage would be ready. And pretty soon the momentum caught on, and people start believing, yes, if Squaw Valley could do it, and different places in Europe could do it. So we did, and finally put together a bid, and the U.S. Olympic Committee picked us twice. First for 1992 when we put in the bid, and that was in the late 80s when we had to submit the bid to the International Committee. And then the first time, unfortunately, we realized it's going to be a learning experience. We lost it to Albertville in France. And then, but then 2 years later was a chance to bid again for the 94. And at that time, we got within one vote.
And that was the year when the corruption was taking place, yes?
That happened a little bit later. And, partially because Salt Lake felt cheated because they thought they had the chance to get it. And U.S. Olympic Committee picked us. And by then, on International Olympic Committee, there was Lillehammer, Norway got it. But years later, there was always a little bit wheeling dealing, and except we Alaskans, we said, "Oh, come on up here and look at our beautiful place, and we'll go take you fishing." That was about as corrupt as we were.
We do that for anybody, anyway, right? Yeah, it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'm talking with Chris von Imhoff. We could, maybe not the father, but certainly the longtime caretaker and manager of Alyeska Resort, and a lot of great stories about building the ski hill over the years. You're mentioning real estate. I guess I never really picked up on this, but a lot of skiing areas rely on real estate. They don't really rely, I mean, they need those lift tickets, but it's sort of the season passes and the cabins and stuff like that that really, really makes it work financially.
Absolutely. And in the 60s, in the early 60s, Alyeska Ski Corporation leased from the state of Alaska 233 acres of land right at the bottom of the mountain. And then there was 160 acres of land. There was fee land that belonged to the resort. The valley floor itself was state lease land. And in 1962, Alyeska Ski Corporation at that time leased it from the state, and then we in turn subdivided and subleased it to private property owners. So it started very slow, and initially the lots were, the roads were meandering around. There wasn't exactly first class construction, and but we subdivided it and started selling the subleasing at that time. The lots at the very beginning was sold for a couple thousand, $2,500. When I first joined in the late 60s, it was sold about $5,000 to $6,000 per lot. That's 100 by 125 square foot lot. That's 12,500 square feet. And but as I say, it brought people in to build cabins and so on. And that, again, that was good customer base. Now, later we were able to convince the state to convert the lease into a fee simple land. And then we acquired, and then then the property owners that had already, they were able to convert into fee land. Later, we were also able to get federal state grants for a water and sewer system for our valley, which was real critical for us. Now the lots sell between $150,000 to $200,000, just for a good choice lot. The real estate did make the difference to a great extent. Sometimes I couldn't pay the bill. I gave them a couple lots, I told some of our staff when things were tough, well, we're issuing paychecks, but not all are going to make it, so you better run to the bank if you want to, get your cash and check cash.
If not for love, you never would have kept this place going, right? I mean, this was a labor of love.
It was, believe me, and people often thought it was crazy, but we survived and prospered eventually, and then found some investors with deeper pockets.
Right. Well, I was going to ask about that. At one time, there was a belief that the Japanese were going to, build the big hotel, and we were going to become an international center, like, in the Alps or like, in the Rockies, and and that was their investment. And there was a little bit of that, but it was still more of a local area, it seems to me. I mean, did that, was that an expectation that didn't come about because of the economy in Japan, or what happened exactly?
Well, basically, when we convinced the Japanese to, when I got to convince them to invest in the resort. At that time, we were just in the process of bidding for the Winter Olympics, and that impressed them that we were chosen already by the U.S. Olympic Committee. And then we were the air crossroads of the world, as you recall. We had at one time 13 international airlines between Europe via Anchorage to Asia. Right. So all the international flights were coming through Anchorage, and so there was a lot of international, and they could lay over. And so that was part of the thing when we initially convinced them that that would be a good location for a summer and winter resort. But later that had changed, you know, Russia then opened up their airspace, and you could fly directly from Europe to Asia. You saved about 3,000 miles going from Europe to Asia. Didn't have to have the crew lay over and so on. So that kind of took away some of that.
Right.
And that, because that now we don't have any more international flights directly in the winter here at all. During the summertime, we have some from Europe and Condor and Icelandair and a few others. But we don't have any direct air service from Asia or from Europe as we used to have before. And that was what changed it to a certain extent.
So the skier, the international skier, there's just places that are easier for them to get to, basically, because of the air travel. Yeah,
exactly. We do get, in springtime, February, March, April, we get quite a few international skiers, and quite a few from Europe because of the heli skiing. Mm. That's unusual that they don't have it over there, because it's pretty well restricted for in the mountains to fly the helicopters, whereas here, so that still is one market. And they, however, have to fly either through Seattle or come on British Airways from London to Seattle and then to Anchorage or with KLM or other carriers. So we do get some, but not the same amount as if you had the direct flights.
Well, I'm sure glad that the Cebu Japanese company came in and built the hotel and the tram and really expanded this place and made it really a fabulous place for us to use.
Anchorage was lucky that we found an investor with deep pockets. At one time when we first negotiated with them, the owner of Cebu Prince Hotel was considered by Forbes magazine as the richest man in the world. They had a big write-up, and so when the company finally agreed to invest in the resort, I never forget when the first time I brought the owner up here, Tsutsumi. Sometimes I called him Mr. Tsunami. He came anyhow, came up right here at the roundhouse, and we looked around, and then he wanted to know what is that land down below on this site below the north face, is that available for development? I said, well, it's right now state land, and then it would have to be selected by the city and the state, and that would take a few years. He said, well, if you can push that through over there, then I'm willing to invest not only in a first class hotel down below, but also in a tram to bring up here. And when he said that, I said, now we have arrived. It was right here outside.
You must have been smiling.
Oh, man, I tell you, I smiled from ear to ear. But it took still quite a few years to get through all the approval and get all that. So it was not, it took 10 years or more to really get everything launched. But I still, I have to tell you one story. Well, talking about the roundhouse. So finally, we were able to build the tram and the hotel down below. And the owner at that time suggested once the new glacier terminal is built, then suggested that the old roundhouse and this should be torn down. Uh-huh. So he thought it just wouldn't fit. I was at that time based in Hawaii for Cebu Prince Hotel. We were building hotels in Maui at McKenna Resort in Honolulu, the Hawaii Prince Hotel. Uh-huh. And because this project had been delayed here with getting all the permits, so the company thought I was the only American hotelier they had, so shipped me over there, which was fine, you know. Instead of worrying about grooming slopes, I worried about golf courses and so on. Mm-hmm. But then when our ski area manager, Larry, told me that the owner had given that direction while I was in Hawaii to tear down this, I said, well, frankly, I'm applying to get back. I wanted to get back to Alaska because this is what I, where I grew up. My my first wife, she was Alaskan, and we had many friends here in Girdwood, Anchorage. So I said, don't do anything with that building. I'll take responsibility when the owner comes. And so I came back, and I think Dale had heard the story, and came up here and I said, what the heck am I going to do to save this building? So then I talked to Judy Bittner, which was with the Anchorage Historical Society.
Yeah, the historical, yeah.
And I said, Judy, is there a chance I can get this thing on the National Historic Register? And she said, yeah, well, that's a very young building. Most things have to be 100 years old and so on. This wasn't even 50 years old. I said, well, I tell you, this is an endangered species. So she said, I'll let you make a presentation to the commission, and if they approve it, we'll forward it to Washington, D.C., and see if they're willing to go for it. So I had another fellow, Keith Trick, and we made the presentation and told him, you know, and there quite a few were skiers on that commission that had been here, been the roundhouse, and of course, even Uncle Ted was here. And so they said, and I told him it's an endangered species, if they could maybe make an exception and make a recommendation, because the first building built here on top of the mountain, that was the only thing we really had at the beginning, and so they agreed, and so then it was forward to D.C., and then of course they engaged Senator Ted to work with the National Historic Organization, and he pushed, you know, he had this leverage at that time to push it through. So then a year later, the owner came after the hotel was finished, and he was real happy with the new property. It was, I think, about 97 or so, and then we decided to come up here with this entourage and look around, and then have dinner in Seven Glaciers, and then he came up here, and I had a Japanese assistant. I briefed him what I'm going to tell him. So when he came around here, and I saw the building, and he kind of, you know, kind of gave a stern look to say, how come this is still here? And then here, as a proud former U.S. Marine, I almost stood at attention. I said, this building is protected by the United States of America. I did. And he looked at me like going nuts. Anyhow, that's exactly what, and then I explained to him that it's was put on the National Historic Register, and that therefore it's protected. We cannot tear it down. And wow, you kind of looked there. But I tried to make him feel good. I said, you know, eventually, hopefully we can make a museum out of it, that move the ski patrol down below where they used to be, and that will help sell more tram tickets and so on. Oh, okay. Then, but he says, don't spend any of our company money. You got to have to raise funds some other ways, which I did. And it took.
And here it is.
It took a couple $1 million to restore it.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Everything from the foundation to the roof and everything in between.
Oh, my
and,
gosh.
Yeah, initially I had an estimate that was $500,000, then it went grew there. So, but we did get a lot of grants. So, the Erasmus Foundation and the whole group of folks that helped contribute. And Girdwood Inc. was at that time formed, and as a nonprofit, and that was the first big project that we tried to get funding through. And so I'm glad to see it now. It's a nice
great
museum.
Yeah,
let me start
you around.
Take around. We'll start right here, of course. In 1778, with Captain Cook coming here.
Oh yeah,
and then. Here you see in 1896 the gold miners, and this is Old Girdwood, where the gold mine operation were being started in 1900. This is Joe Girdwood right here.
Oh, wow. Never seen that before.
On the right side. And then there's a little village of Girdwood.
Looks like they would have had good skiing if they'd known what skiing was.
Yeah. So then here shows some pictures of the area, and then here when they started building the rail track in 1914, and then surveying the land. Then here the gold mining was continued. This is the Monarch Mine, which is up above Crow Creek Mine.
Right.
And here in 1924, Lathrop, they made a movie here.
Cap Lathrop, Oh, the Chichacos.
Yeah, the Chichacos, exactly. And here's a fellow named Arnie Erickson. He founded the gold mine, and which is now Crow Creek Mine, and Upper Crow Pass. Over here, you see then the early skiers that hiked up here from the bottom.
1937, they're already skiing here in 1937. Wow.
A few diehards, old-timers.
They must have been really tough, huh?
Yeah.
There's no helicopter. There was
The helicopter came a little bit later. Joe Danich, he was the owner of the original Tesoro gas station. And built, which is at that time was a Texaco station. And there was a Little Dipper, and there was also the post office, the main bar and restaurant in Old Girdwood in 1939. That's when I was born, I hate to admit it. And then eventually, of course, the Seward Highway was being built and expanded. And then this is a fellow named Ernie Bowman, who was also a pilot. And he's the one who flew around all over to look for a good ski area.
1955, so he chose the spot.
He chose the spot. He kind of recommended to the local residents that this would be, to Anchorage folks, that this would be a good place. And then here's a little later picture still of Old Girdwood.
Yeah, looks like a real old Alaska bush town, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, it was. Unfortunately, then it got covered in the 1964 earthquake.
Right.
Here's a Frenchman called François de Gunsberg that originally was their first investor that they found in 57. But by the time they built the lift, this chairlift number one, it was 1960.
Oh, yeah. Which is still there. And it looks pretty rickety compared to what we ride on now.
Of course, you know the statehood. That was the big... and then 63, we hosted the U.S. Olympic tryouts and U.S. national championships right here on the mountain. And they didn't have any snow cats, and so they had to actually bring the military help. They have military maneuvers to pack the pack the trails in order so they would hold up. And in 64, unfortunately, we had the earthquake flooded Lower Girdwood and town center of Girdwood. And so then it was relocated to Midtown of Girdwood.
So what we think of now as Girdwood was just probably a forest then, and the town was down by the water.
Yeah. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
In 67, that's when I joined the resort. This is my wife, Nina. She was a former Miss Alaska. And you see in the back the roundhouse picture. We were doing some PR for Alaska Airlines to help promote it, so they had a professional photographer come up here. Even though nowadays sometimes people say, "Is that you?" And I say, "Yeah." What happened? So 1970, it continued to grow, and I always loved to go down the Seward Highway and see the sheep on the side of it.
Yeah, that hasn't changed much.
And in 73, then we hosted the World Cup, which was the first World Cup. They had one scheduled in Japan, and they had one prior to that just in Europe. And so we put in a bid because they had to lay over here at that time too. Yeah. So we were able to host it.
It's interesting to look at that and see the ungroomed snow, that they're having a competition on ungroomed snow.
They required a lot of boot packing and ski packing in order to, so that it wouldn't completely. We did have a Tucker Snowcat, a couple of thiocols, but nothing what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Then here it is in 1980 when we sold it to the Japanese, and the gentleman in the center with the white jacket, there was a Mr. Tsutsumi, and was considered one of the richest men in the world. And he bought his own helicopter pilot, the guy in the black suit in the middle. And then there were the air helicopter pilot and a few folks from Japan, and I'm at the far right-hand side right there. And
thank you, Mr. Tsutsumi.
Hai dozo. And in here that we had the airline races, and then the junior and national championships. And then, of course, we got Hillary Lind.
Of course.
Now
we're looking at the kids who grew up on this mountain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This, on this mountain, that's where we're very proud of our racing program, where we developed some of the top Olympic skiers.
We did.
So here's Hillary Lind, and there's Tommy Moe, who won the gold medal in 1994.
Look how young he looks, yeah.
Yeah, he looks like a young kid. And then Rosie Fletcher is right in 2006 when she won a bronze in the Olympics. And she was so happy because she did a couple times before. She was a real great snowboarder, but a couple times she just somehow fell during the previous Olympics. But this time she made it. And the last picture is of John Byrne with his two daughters, who in 2006 bought the resort, and I'm very happy. he did, and he's been a good investor and continued to upgrade the resort. So I think Anchorage and Girdwood, we were all lucky again to continue to find some mm-hmm. investors that really have a passion for the mountain and the resort.
The first time I got on chair four and then zipped right up the mountain, I was, thank you, sir. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. That old lift was so slow.
You didn't
the
enjoy
so
the
fast.
Scenery before when it was slow?
Well, it must be a really nice feeling for you to look at, these Olympians, but also all the kids, and actually not kids anymore, yeah. middle-aged people who grew up on this mountain and enjoyed and learned so much from the place you built.
So many good old-timers. Let me just show you one other little picture. Here is when we opened up the Sitzmark and Alyeska Nugget in 1970. This was Charlie Willis, the chairman of Alaska Airlines. And here's Keith Miller, the former governor. And there's my wife, Nina. And there I am, and we're just talking. So that was in the early years when my wife was dog mushing.
Oh, neat.
And I still remember all those good days.
Yeah. Well, you've made a wonderful home here, and you also still spend time back in your birthplace over in Europe, too.
Right. Well, basically...
Yeah. You're still skiing, of course.
Of course, yeah. But I must admit, I'm now more of a fair-weather skier. When it's snowing, blowing, and the visibility not so good, I say, well, let the ski patrol and the diehards. Uh-huh. But the snow itself up here is good. But yes, I still do, but... I have a place now in Europe where I originally grew up, and so I go back and forth. But about 55% of the time I'm here in Alaska, because my three boys, grandchildren, and my business and so other things are still here. But then I have a home in the Tyrolean Alps, and so we go back and forth between here and there.
Well, fabulous. It's so nice to have gotten this time to talk. I really appreciate it. And thank you on behalf of all Anchorage skiers for your part in building this place.
It was my pleasure, and even though it was challenging, but the result, when you go now, I take a lot of pride to see that we have reached a new level. And we're also lucky that we have not only winter, but summer tourism. That's and I worked closely with the cruise ship company, tour companies and so on. So the summer actually for the hotel is even busier than during the winter. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of a year-round destination resort. And that's really important in order to be able to break even or make some money.
We want it to be profitable so we can keep skiing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, Charles, thank you. My pleasure that you took the time out. And here's Madame President of Girdwood Inc., Dale Goodwin.
So stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats next Thursday at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and today we are talking about Alyeska Resort, our wonderful hometown ski hill, which has made a big difference in so many people's lives. And I really enjoyed talking with Chris von Imhoff in the first half at the Roundhouse Museum. And I've got a huge treat for the second half, too. Rosie Fletcher is with me, bronze medalist in the snowboard back in 2006 in Torino, and somebody I've always wanted to talk to. And she came into the studio to talk about how she learned to ski and board at Alyeska and her family memories, which are now going into the third generation. Thanks for being with us, Rosie.
Thanks for having me.
So you were saying that your family or your dad originally came to Alyeska, you know, to ski, right? I mean, what's the story? How did that come about?
You know, he had spent a year in Kitzbühel as kind of the quintessential ski bomb.
Okay.
Alyeska was always on the bucket list, so he came up and eventually ended up meeting my mom in the old day lodge.
Oh, yeah, yeah, which is very different from what we've got now.
Yes,
right?
Very different.
Yeah. So that would have been like the 1960s?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So what is your first memory of being on that ski slope?
You know, my first memory is riding up the rope tow, and it was, you know, just the cable rope and burning through gloves.
Yeah.
And I also remember wearing the bags because it rained a lot, and everybody's talking about a lot of rain, and, you know, some of my fondest memories are skiing in the rain.
So it's always rained. So yeah. You like wearing garbage bags, in other
words. Oh, yeah. Alyeska used to hand them out, and it had the Alyeska Resort logo on them.
So you basically learned to ski before you, I mean, just as a toddler.
Yes.
And a lot of us did, yeah. Mm. So when you do that, you become so comfortable with it that you never, I mean, I think kids who are lucky enough to learn to ski when they're really small never develop any fear, right? They just sort of feels natural.
Yes, definitely. And I also think that growing up skiing has also created a connection with the earth and being outside, and I definitely feel a lot more comfortable with the wind in my face and and being amongst the snow and the trees.
Yeah, and it's so great that you were able to really make a career out of that and just pursue it. But when you were a kid in Girdwood Elementary School, was just skiing a part of life for everybody there?
Yes, I remember there were 2 days a week that after school, you would go home, get dressed, and there was night skiing. And that was definitely something that we all looked forward to.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and then, you know, you go to the Roundhouse and have hot chocolate and French fries. And it was all part of this really wonderful experience.
So the Roundhouse was kind of the mountaintop sort of, we now have a fancy cafeteria, but it was like sort of snack bar up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So which lifts existed when you were first skiing?
There was chair one, chair four, chair three, chair two. I am old enough to remember chair two. And another fond memory I have is in the spring, chair four used to go just past chair one. And so when you were riding up almost to the top, you could look over to your left and there was the big sun deck. And on the beautiful sunny days, warm, everybody was always out there and enjoying.
Uh-huh. So do you have any, I mean, I remember being a kid and sort of getting on a chairlift for the first time and thinking, ah, this is terrifying. Do you have any memory like that? Or were you so young and so like part of skiing culture that it was completely natural for you from the beginning?
I don't remember having any fears. However, now that I have small children,
yeah.
I'm thinking, what were my parents thinking just sending us off on this chairlift with a bag on nonetheless? How slippery, you know, all those things now go through your mind. But no, shoot, we would... And I think about playing on the chairlift and taking goggles and ski poles at night. So
it all seemed to work out all right.
Yeah.
I was riding up to on the, you know, the beginner chair three last winter, and they stuck a couple of little kids between me and my daughter. And just little tiny kids. And one of them says to the other, I wonder what it'd be like to jump off. And I'm like, no, this is what I signed up for.
Yeah. No, that's definitely going through their minds.
Yeah.
I see it.
Everything is going through their minds. Yeah. So did you learn to ski by having somebody show you how to do it, or do you learn to ski by just being thrown on the hill and just doing it?
I remember a friend of my parents taking us up, but you know, at the time the rope tow was right next to chair three, and it's a pretty gentle slope.
Yeah.
And I just remember making laps.
Mm-hmm.
Making laps.
Yeah. And then when did you switch over to snowboard?
So at the time I was ski racing, and looking back,
Mighty Mites?
Well, I was a junior, so I was about 15 years old.
Okay.
And looking back, I was not a very good ski racer, but boy, did I have heart. So
yeah.
I didn't end up making this big junior Olympic competition that was being held in Sun Valley. And so while all of my friends went out to this big ski race, I was at home and my friend had lent me her snowboard while she was off racing. And I looked at that snowboard. I'm like, when she gets back, I'm going to be a better snowboarder. And really, I have this very vivid memory, like it was yesterday, being on chair three and finally connecting a toe side to heel side turn. And it was really then I just knew that I had found my passion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
So how did you know that, I mean, in terms of not being a good ski racer, that totally surprised me to hear you say that. I would have think like you would be good at everything on snow.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I had heart. And I think when you believe so strongly in something, you give it everything you have. And yeah, I just wasn't. And perhaps it was because I started ski racing late.
Oh.
But the technique and the things that I learned in ski racing definitely helped me as I carried it over into snowboard competition.
Yeah. So with snowboarding kind of, I mean, it was in that period when it was sort of taking off and there was actually some kind of weird conflict between the two. You know, between the two user groups a little bit.
You know, when I think back, when I first started snowboarding, you had to get this license to shred, which meant that one of the ski instructors had to watch you and make sure that you were safe to go down the hill and that you could make turns. And, you know, again, as I reflect back, like, why didn't skiers have to do that? Because
really
there
were
some
weird,
really
yeah.
crazy skiers
I'll
on
say.
The hill.
I'll
but,
say,
you
yeah.
know, I mean, it was something new and they were trying their best, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so there were only a handful of snowboarders at the time. And I remember you'd be on the chair and you'd see him. And you'd say, hey, there's Carl or there's Colleen. Or we were definitely a tight-knit group that were very supportive.
Uh-huh.
And they were very good snowboarders. I think Alyeska produces very good snowboarders and skiers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is that you've got a pretty challenging mountain compared to other resorts. You know, it's not like a beginner hill. And if you live in Girdwood, you're just skiing all the time. And it's all about like time on the snow, right?
Yes, definitely. I think that the snow conditions, the visibility, and definitely the vertical all play into creating really excellent all-around skiers and snowboarders.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about what it's like to be in that sort of youth racing world. Do those folks become sort of your whole circle of friends in terms of like you're like practicing and working out with them all the time?
Yes, definitely, especially as you get onto the World Cup level. Some of my fondest memories on the World Cup were the friendships that I made, in addition to some of the wonderful places I got to visit.
I'm sure.
You know, but definitely it was the relationships that were created, not the races. Certainly uh-huh. that's not what I think back on
huh.
when I think about that experience.
So at what age did you actually get up to where you were, you know, being really pretty successful as a racer and seeing that you were going to take it somewhere?
I remember there was an event at Squaw Valley and my dad was there and I had graduated high school and I was kind of pushing college off, you know, hoping to make something happen with snowboarding. And I ended up winning this race and it was against this fellow American who was, you know, top three in the world at the time. And when I won, I just looked at my dad and I was like, this is it. I mean, and I think once he saw it and he saw it in person and really could feel my commitment and desire to succeed, then he was like, okay, you can make it happen. It wasn't shortly after that they announced that snowboarding was going to be in the Olympics in 98. So then
oh,
it
wow.
was go time.
So you were like right at the cutting edge.
Yeah.
So, but he must have like believed because he really loved skiing. It wasn't like you were coming from Florida or something and had people who didn't get it at all. Did you
yeah,
get some support from that?
You know,
that?
But he didn't know, at the time snowboarding was so new, he didn't know much about it. There wasn't the structure and the support in place that ski racing had. So, you know, it was definitely new territory for everybody.
It seems strange that there, in hindsight, it seems kind of weird that there would be any resistance to it. You know, it's just another thing you do on the snow. There's nothing mm-hmm. more hazardous about it, right? I mean, it seems like it
change
would,
is hard, man.
Yeah, that's right. They've got one board step
yeah,
too.
Change right? is hard.
It's like the star-bellied sneech, right?
Yeah.
You know. So you decided at that point that you were really going to make a career of this, and did you put off education at that point?
I did.
Mm. Uh-huh. Mm. And how did that work out for you? I mean, was it a good? I mean, obviously, it's a great decision in terms of what you did with your life, but was it harder sort of to come back to it later? And I reason asked this because. Mm. every parent thinks about these decisions with their kid. You know, how much should you let the kid really focus on sports or on one passion, and how much should you try to force them to be broad-based and stuff?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just different for each individual. It's hard to say. But however, I will say that I did go back.
Sounds like nobody was going to stop you.
Yeah, no. But I will say I did go back to education and kind of just chipped away at it. So,
What was it like when there was first starting to be a national team in snowboarding and you were just on the beginning of that? What was the, did you feel like you're blazing a new trail for everybody?
At the time, I didn't. I mean, I was young and I was just living the dream, doing what I loved.
Fun,
and and really, I feel like when you're passionate and you have the drive, it never seems hard, or you never imagine you're doing anything other mm-hmm. than what you love. And I just remember being very focused and determined. And
yeah.
But you know what? There's nothing like the Olympics to validate a sport. And that's really
that's
going
right.
into Nagano. We were like, all right, seeing hockey and all these different sports, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden we were like legitimate.
Yeah.
So, and that's been great for the sport.
For sure. Yeah. It's almost overshadowed skiing during Olympics more recently. Yeah. Because it's so much fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Walforth, and we're talking about Alyeska and the history and the kind of personal story of Alyeska. And with me right now is Rosie Fletcher, a bronze medalist in snowboarding and kind of one of the pioneers from this sport, as we're hearing about, who grew up on that hill and is still skiing and just back this weekend from skiing all weekend, or boarding probably.
No, I was skiing.
Oh,
you were
skiing. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm interested, and this is probably kind of an ignorant question, but when you were snowboarding at that, you know, Olympic top level, is it all in your sort of intuition and your practice and just your, you know, knowing what you're going to do, sort of like muscle memory? Or is there some level where you're saying, well, if I make this little technique change, I'll be a little bit better? I mean, how do you get better when you're at that level?
My dad told me when I was ski racing that when you get to a certain level of elite sports, that it's 90% mental and 10%, you know, physical.
Uh-huh.
And I honestly believe that everybody does get to a certain level and you are tweaking little things. Even during the race, a coach will recommend a tweak here and there, but it's mental. And that's a tough thing to keep consistent throughout a whole season.
Mental in terms of kind of getting in the zone and doing what you know how to do without sort of overthinking it, getting pulled out by the competition and the stress and all that.
Just letting your body know, do what it knows how to do. Your brain just gets in the way a lot.
So, and you, in one of your Olympics, I believe it was in 2002, you kind of had a big disappointment. And was that sort of because of what you're talking about?
Yes, 2002 was interesting. I went into the games ranked second in the world. I had a mock up of a Wheaties box. Like, if you convinced.
Too much
pressure. It was. And I remember standing at the top of the course, and depending on where you're racing, oftentimes you can see the bottom, or sometimes due to the terrain, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I could. And I remember feeling the rumble of the crowd on the ground and the Alaska flags waving. And I think what it was that my fear of failure just overrode any type of success or any type of just allowing your body to do what it knows how to do.
Somehow you've got to almost get outside of your own mind.
Definitely.
And have all of that stuff disappear.
Definitely.
So did that happen for you in 06?
I think so. I knew that it was my last season and I just said, I'm snowboarding because I loved it, and I kind of reconnected with those early days at Alyeska. Said I never started snowboarding for the Olympics or for this, for Wheaties boxes or whatever. I did it because I loved it, and I found myself in it. So it was just reconnecting with those old feelings.
Cool. Yeah. I imagine that probably translates into life. I mean, that's pretty major lesson to learn about how to sort of believe in what is really important.
Yeah. But you know what? Nothing that involves love is ever easy. You know, it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. So, you must, when you watch the Olympics now, you must sort of see the athletes going through that in a way that the rest of us really can't.
oh gosh, I get way more nervous watching other people compete.
Uh-huh.
It's like that lack of control thing.
Yeah.
So torture.
Yeah. So tell me now, you have obviously skied and snowboarded like at all the best resorts all over the world. I know Alyeska is pretty small. I skied in the Rockies a little bit, and I was kind of blown away after skiing all my life at Alyeska. Like, wow, this is huge. So how do you compare it to other resorts? I mean, what other ski hills around the world?
I've always, Alaska has always been my top priority in terms of when I was traveling around uh-huh. the world and you know, telling people, they would see the Alaska flag on my snowboard or ask me where I was from, especially in Europe. And Alyeska definitely holds a special place in my heart. And sure, it's not big, but like what we talked about earlier with the terrain and the conditions, it really tests your ability and also just makes you a really good athlete.
Yeah, you have plenty of opportunity to challenge yourself, even if mm-hmm. it's not on a different run every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that community aspect probably has a big difference in our producing really good athletes too, because it's not like you have to drive 5 hours to get there.
Yeah.
You know?
And the community in general has always been very supportive. We're small, mm-hmm. We're a winter sports state. And so that's also been a bonus. And you know, I remember when I was standing on the podium at the Olympics, and you have three people from three different countries, and certainly the podium wasn't big enough, because for each one of us, it took so many people to make that happen. Oh, and wow. I feel yeah. that Alaska in general, and I guess that's why I always spoke so highly of it, because mm-hmm. I was always so proud to be an Alaskan and mm-hmm. to have the support that I had. And Girdwood's a wonderful community for
yeah.
that.
So now you are teaching your own kids to ski, and I'm just curious, and they're 4 and 6?
Mm-hmm.
You can shout out to them if you want to. What are their names?
Oscar and Olga.
All right. And tell me about that experience. That must be a nice full circle experience for you.
It is. Going full circle from, you know, imagining how my dad felt riding up Chair One. He had a young family, three mm-hmm. daughters, with a passion for skiing. And as a youth myself, riding up Chair One and connecting with my own passion for skiing and snowboarding, and now seeing the light in my son's eyes as he is so enthusiastic about telling us about riding Chair 6 for the first time. And I think anytime children, adults, people can be outside and be enthusiastic about it, it's a good thing.
Yeah, and it's so nice to see your kids get the courage that they can get on the mountain, which is essentially a safe place for them. I mean, they can do challenges, they can do something that's scary, but essentially it's not like, I mean, it's a contained area, right? And mm-hmm. they can have some freedom and all mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
And I really hope for my kids. My sisters and I were outside all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said earlier, I feel much more comfortable being outside, and especially when the wind's blowing or the rain, I have the connection with rain yeah. growing up in Girdwood. And,
yes.
And I do. I feel it in my heart. There's something really comfortable about it. So I'm hoping that our children can feel that.
They'll get it too. They probably mm-hmm. will. Sounds like yeah. you spend a lot of time there.
Yeah, gosh, I love it.
Not tired of it yet?
No.
Awesome. Well, that's so good to hear. Well, thanks so much, Rosie
yeah,
Fletcher.
Thank you.
Olympic snowboard bronze medalist mm-hmm. from 2006, mom here in Anchorage, and a great community member. Maybe you'll see her out there at Alyeska. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank Chris von Imhoff, who visited with us actually at the Roundhouse Museum, where you can see Rosie's picture at the top of the mountain, and our producer, Eric Bork, who does a great job of putting the show together, and Grace Bogine, our production assistant, who helps with booking the shows. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.